Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
You know, AI could bring Jerry back.
I don't think it could. I don't have as much faith in AI as you do.
Let's get to our guest because we want to talk about some of the challenges facing the music industry due to artificial intelligence. With us again right here on Bloomberg Business Week, Michael Hoppe. He's president and CEO of Sound Exchange, an organization that essentially collects royalties for music creators, right? I'm saying it right. Yeah, back in studio. Good to have you back with us.
Pleasure to be here. Always happy to come and chat with you about whatever issues are on your mind.
Well, there's a lot of issues that my therapist is working on.
You don't want to get into her mind.
Exactly. Having said that, AI, talk to us about your members or the folks that you work with. Are they a little nervous about the rise of AI?
So look, AI is a very interesting topic in the music industry right now. There's certainly concerns about it, but there's a lot of opportunities as well. On the one hand, when you think about the issues that AI brings, I typically put them into three buckets: legal, cultural, and financial. On the legal front, there are a lot of copyright issues about what is AI allowed to scrape. Can you go and scrape copyrighted contents? For instance, all of those very excellent, databases out there that you guys supply. Is AI allowed to scrape copyrighted things? When AI creates a product, is it copyrighted? These are all some questions that are being engaged, although we think copyright law pretty much protects creators the way they need to. But you know what people don't talk about as much? And thank you for bringing up Drake and The Weeknd.
You're very welcome.
It isn't just about copyright law. It's equally about artists' rights, creators' rights, what we call name, image, and likeness. The thing that bothers...
But they took their sound, right?
Took their sound, but what you're also doing when you imitate an artist with fully, creative AI...
You're drunk in a bar singing karaoke?
Excuse me?
No.
Oh, yeah. You're basically marketing on the brand and the image that Drake and The Weeknd, and that's just not right in any scenario.
Agreed, right? It's a brand. It's their branding.
But it's not just about the legal part either. What I think the music industry wants everybody to be aware of is there's this cultural component as well. There's something about human artistry that we're actually part of a coalition called the Human Artistry Campaign.com. It talks about, as an industry, not just music, but all the creative industry, it talks about, look, AI is a really cool tool, and we should talk about the benefits that it brings to the music industry and elsewhere, but let's not forget the human element. Let's not forget the value that human artistry brings.
I think that's irreplaceable also, Michael. I mean, to be fair, AI could be really helpful in the studio. If you're a guitarist, like a singer-songwriter, and you want a certain drum beat, you can probably much more easily now get AI to create that for you with whatever time signature you want and, whatever drum kit you want it to sound like. But you're not going to be able to write the kind of hit that resonates with people, for generations with a software program right now.
So you are absolutely right on, and it reminds.
I disagree. I think you're going to be able to use AI to write songs.
Yes, you can use AI to write songs, but you're not going to be able to churn out a Stairway to Heaven. You're not going to be able to do a great Eagles Greatest Hits Volume 2. You're not going to be able to get an Alanis Morissette. Something that sells millions of copies and speaks to people in their hearts for 20, 30, 40 years. A jingle, yes. A commercial, okay. But you're not going to be able to really move people
Time
with a software program.
Time will tell.
I've got two responses to that. First of all, AI is actually not that new.
Correct.
What's new is, you know, completely generative AI, but AI has been around in the music industry and elsewhere for decades. Brian Eno, back in 1996, not to date myself, you know, talked about, he actually put out an album and talked about AI music. And it's been, as you said, drum kits, synthesizers, you know, voice modulation. So it's been around for a long time. What's the game changer is predictive. But to your point about not being able to replace it, I'm reminded I was in an industry event just 2 days ago here in New York. And Joe Walsh, speaking of the Eagles. Was
genius.
Joe Walsh.
I saw Joe Walsh
was
at the
giving
Beacon
an award.
And big time love of Stevie Nicks, by the way.
Yes. Well, who doesn't?
Really? I know.
And he had a great quote that stuck with me. He's talked about AI briefly when he was giving this award. And he said, look, you know, we're all being told that the future is AI, and pretty soon hits are going to be shot from these, you know, digital cannons at the speed of sound, and we're all going to become obsolete. Needless to say, Joe Walsh thought that was a lot of BS, and he had a quote that I will never forget. He said all of that, and he said, you know what? You can't program the gift of a songwriter or the soul of an artist.
I agree 100%.
And that is exactly the
Think
point.
Think about Midnight in Harlem.
I know.
Carol, you know, Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks, they have such a unique sound, and the way they work as artists and the way they work together. I don't believe that a computer program, whether it's generative or not, can replace that.
Now, there are.
I guess what I'm saying is that they could maybe create a song. I'm not necessarily saying like that what you get in a live element or, you know, performers singing together, like there's something that's magical. But I do think you could use AI easily, machine learning, generative AI, to help fill out a song,
totally.
Fill out lyrics.
Absolutely. And actually, Carol, that's a great point. AI, a lot of the industry also sees the upside. All of the industry sees the upside of AI. Let me tell you some of the positives.
I want AI, right, Matt? We want AI to do our job.
As there's so many use cases, I think it would help. But I don't think it's going to replace.
Okay.
You know what
Fair.
I want AI?
I
want AI, like, in, you know, the new Indiana Jones movie that is coming out? The first segment of that film, they have taken practically unlimited tapes and videos from earlier Indiana Jones, and they de-aged him. Indiana Jones, not Sean Connery.
Harrison Ford.
That's what I want.
In fact, if
you're putting this on webcast, can you do that to me before post-production? That'd be good. But there's other things AI can do.
John Lennon, you know, AI, Paul McCartney talking about it and being able to extricate, you know, some of his voice from a demo about 2 years before he died in 1980. Yeah.
Music resurrection.
For
those of you who don't know, I mean, they're pulling out from a demo tape. And they're going to release the Beatles' last record.
Yeah.
They haven't
so
said
cool.
no one is. They haven't officially said what the title of the record is, but a lot
Who
of people are predicting.
Who owns that? John Lennon.
Well, it's done with John Lennon's permission. It's done, you know, with his estate's permission.
And we got to run. We got to run. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Come
back
soon. Thank
you
very much.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right. Well, anyway, there's definitely been carnage in the crypto space. So let's get to it. And certainly the most recent when it comes to the SEC suits against both Coinbase and Binance. Corey Clipston is CEO at the crypto trading app Swan Bitcoin, back with us on Zoom in LA. Corey, good to check in with you again. There certainly has been quite the clampdown here in the United States. What do you make of the SEC suits?
Yeah. Hi, Carol and Matt. It's great to be back. It is a pretty fascinating time, isn't it? This is kind of the what a lot of folks in the Bitcoin space, meaning Bitcoin, none of the altcoins, have been predicting was going to happen for many years, frankly, going back to, I think it was February 2018 that Jay Clayton started to make it very clear that his position and the SEC's position, even that far back, was that, pretty much everything other than Bitcoin was going to be a security, other than maybe some of these smaller proof of work coins that don't really have much market cap would probably be considered commodities as well. And I think we've seen that pretty consistently broadcast from Gensler's SEC over the last couple of years. And, you know, you can do all of the legal screening that you want with your own internal lawyers if you're a crypto casino or a crypto exchange. But at the end of the day, that doesn't make law. And so the laws on the books basically say these things are securities, and they'll probably have to get laws changed by Congress if they want to operate these sort of crypto equities in the
exactly
States.
I mean, fighting the SEC is not usually a winning strategy. Maybe it's better to appeal to the people and try and get things changed at a congressional level. Looks like that's what Coinbase, for example, is doing. Corey, is it are proof of stake tokens or proof of stake blockchains more likely to be securities than proof of work blockchains?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much inevitable. I think that it's, you know, one of these things where they say, like, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, acts like a duck, it's probably a duck, and that's interest, right? So I think that's we also have not seen any proof of stake project remotely approach decentralization. You know, the Ethereum roadmap is still completely controlled by Vitalik. The whole ecosystem is marketed by kind of an Ethereum industrial complex of Consensus, Ethereum Foundation, Coinbase, Circle, Andreessen Horowitz, Paradigm, few venture funds. So they can say all they want and try to get Ethereum to be the one centrally controlled crypto that gets a pass. And that's, I think, what their kick save is to try to get through. But it doesn't have the benefit of being true. And so we'll see how that plays out.
I just love it. I don't have an opinion officially, so I'm not saying I totally agree, but if I were a person who had an opinion.
First of all, you always have an opinion.
I've never found proof of stake to be, to me, it doesn't fulfill the OG, promise of crypto, and it certainly doesn't feel decentralized at all.
For those who aren't cool kids in the room, just talk a little bit about, Corey, if you will, proof of stake versus proof of work, because it has to do with valid verification of crypto transactions. But why this?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, proof of work means that you're expending energy to secure the network, and proof of stake means that you're just trusting humans to kind of coordinate together. And basically, the rich get richer. And if you have more Ethereum or more Cardano or more Solana, then you get more. And that fundamentally leads towards centralization. The second derivative of that is more and more centralization, regardless of where your starting point is. And it basically just means that humans are still running it, and humans change the monetary policy. As we've seen throughout the history of Ethereum, for instance, the monetary policy is just changeable at a whim according to the directives of Joe Lubin at Consensus and Vitalik Buterin at the Ethereum Foundation.
Tell us about Swan and how consumers can use it, can interact with your company. Yeah. And then who custodies the Bitcoin?
Yeah, so we are a pretty diversified Bitcoin financial services firm. So at present, we offer brokerage, we offer the Swan IRA, we offer private client services through swanprivate.com. And then we have a whole wealth division that works with financial advisors and RIAs and helps them get Bitcoin into their client portfolios. Later this year, we'll be launching Swan Custody. We purchased a company called Spectre last year, which is one of the top multi-sig custodian softwares out there. It's free open source software, and that team has been building on top of their protocol to build Swan Custody. And then we're also launching asset-backed loans, should be in market with asset-backed loans this summer. And we think with those services, you basically fulfill essentially all of the needs or most of the needs that anyone who is into Bitcoin and thinking about it for their business or for their portfolio or their family would need to sort of check those boxes to have a relationship. And I think the key to our success so far has been that we just have a lot of the top experts in the world on Bitcoin and on financial services at the intersection. Like our senior team and all of our salespeople come from, you know, Goldman, Bridgewater, Morgan Stanley, Deutsche Bank, these different places, but are longtime Bitcoiners as well. And so they kind of speak both languages, and that really helps us translate what's going on for people.
Corey, you sound like it's full speed ahead. What was the impact, though, of those SEC suits against Coinbase and Binance? What kind of either slowdown or just maybe pull back a little bit that you see, or even a lot as a result of that?
Yeah, I mean, for us, this was like the oceans parting in front of us and saying, oh my gosh, there's, you know, 3 years of open field running at least for Bitcoin financial services. And so we immediately greenlit tripling the sales team, and I greenlit a 15x in ad spend last week. So nice. We're going really, really hard after this. We think this is the moment to tell the truth without a lot of distraction from the what I'd say the orange washing affinity marketers on the crypto side of the fence. And so I think this is salad days for those people that thought Bitcoin was the thing that really, really matters, which, you know, again, happens to be true.
And do you expect all of these other businesses to be pushed offshore? I mean, in the case of Coinbase, it looks like Brian Armstrong wants to stand and fight, but everyone else seems to be heading for the hills in Europe or Asia.
Yeah, I mean, I think the payoff is so massive if they're somehow able to get some kind of accommodation or, you know, again, you know, try to fight something through Congress or whatever. Don't think they'll succeed with that, again, just because when people that take laws and markets very seriously look at it, they'll kind of spot the hypocrisy of, you know, regulate me specially, but not the other guys, not the penny stock operators, not the multi-level marketers and the Ponzi schemers. They only want sort of new regulations for their little corner of fraud and chicanery. And I don't think they'll get away with it.
Yeah.
I'm not pro-regulation, but I am anti-scam, and I'm definitely anti-hypocrisy. So again, if you want to open up the floodgates and let all these things through, then I think you have to look at basically every corner of the market, and, you know, you'll probably have to see a dramatic reduction in the scope of regulation across the board, because there's so many people across TradFi that would like a light touch in their little area. That's their pet project too.
I do think we have to jump in and point out that these SEC suits have made allegations.
Correct.
And those brought by the CFTC as well. But no one has been proven guilty yet.
Correct.
So we can't use words like fraud or chicanery. Those lead to real problems.
Yeah. Time will tell. Ultimately.
Yes.
Listen, though, really great to get your opinion because you are certainly in the thick of it. Corey Clipston, he's Chief Executive Officer at Swan Bitcoin.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Really cool story on the Bloomberg. We've all been kind of yakking about it in the newsroom. The world's two richest individuals lunching together today in Paris. We're talking about Elon Musk and Bernard Arnault, the CEO and controlling shareholder of LVMH Moët.
Is it Moët and Hennessy?
Moët Hennessy?
Yeah. I don't know.
I didn't take French. Anyway, Louis Vuitton, we know. I think he is the world's richest dude, right, at this point?
Bernard Arnault, I think he was jumped by Elon Musk.
So
you
can
just type R-I-C-H Go, Rich Go, and you'll see Elon Musk is currently worth $229.4 billion, and Bernard Arnault has a paltry $196.8 billion.
They are the world's two richest individuals, which I started off with. Okay, Arnault's sons were there. Elon Musk's mother, May, also took part. I got to say, Elon has been everywhere, including meeting with auto execs, bringing them into the family via the Tesla charging station. So we knew we wanted to talk a little bit about Tesla, which has been on quite a run as well, the share price. Ross Gerber is back with us, president and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management, owner of Tesla's, investor in the stock, one-time activist vying for a Tesla board seat. He is all in when it comes to Tesla. He's on the phone from Santa Monica. Ross, how are you?
I'm good. Good to be back.
It's kind of interesting.
It's very interesting. I will also say, as a longtime listener, so Ross, I'm just filling in for Tim Stenovec.
Matt loves listening when you join
I love us. It when you're on the program. So today when we were like, we need to talk about Tesla because it looks like it's kind of all coming together again for Elon Musk. I was like, man, we could get Ross Gerber on. So that would be awesome. So I'm psyched to have you on the program. The Supercharger Network, I'm just so jazzed about this because it looks like he hit it out of the park. And he did something that consortiums of automakers haven't been able to do, and governments haven't been able to do. It just looks like a stroke of genius.
Well, I mean, it's economics that really ultimately won the game here, because the economics of using the supercharger versus not using the supercharger system was so much better for Ford and GM to just jump on this to help them sell cars. It really became a win-win situation for both parties. And that was sort of the deft, how would I say, maneuvering that Tesla's done over the last several years in building out the supercharger network, which ironically I had spent a lot of time working on in the last 6 months trying to really value this network. And now I'm like, wow, they just killed it. Like, this is an amazing thing for Tesla.
I think it's incredible on so many different levels that Elon went from, I think, people scratching their heads, worried about his involvement in Twitter, to, you know, he's got somebody now who's going to be heading up Twitter. He's pulled Ford and GM right into Twitter spaces to talk about their involvement. So he's giving kind of credibility, if you will, and showing how Twitter spaces can be this incredible communications platform to do something like that. I don't know. When you look at the big picture of Elon, like Matt said, just getting it all together or what?
Yeah, sort of. I think, you know, they're sort of like SpaceX and Tesla and Twitter. You can kind of say like, well, they have like, what would they all have in common? But then there's these like threads that connect everything. And, you know, it's really interesting the way the things sort of work out that he's now hired sort of the top people from NBC to run Twitter, you know, and then he's been able to refocus on Tesla, which is exactly what I was hoping would happen. And the minute he starts refocusing his efforts on Tesla, we've just seen a tremendous amount of progress in the business. So, you know, now with all this, you know, deal-making talk in France, and boy, you know, my French contacts are basically saying this looks like it's going to be a done deal. And that's huge. It's huge for France and Tesla.
He was in Italy right before this. So he's met with, I think, the heads of government of at least two European nations. And of course, he already has great relationships in Germany. It's pretty interesting, though, that even Twitter seems to be firing on all cylinders, if you'll excuse a horrible pun that doesn't make sense with EVs.
I can't believe
Ross,
you did that.
I mean, you know, when we had the first presidential announcement on Twitter, it seemed like it wasn't working very well. But now he brought Ford on. We all had to tune in for that. He brought GM on. We all had to tune in for that. He's turned Twitter Spaces into the place to be right now, hasn't he, Ross?
Yeah, Twitter Spaces is an amazing place. I mean, this week I was on a space and Walter Isaacson came on, and next thing you know, I'm talking to Walter Isaacson about the book he's releasing on Elon and comparing him to Leo da Vinci and to Steve Jobs. And, you know, it was just an incredible space, and there were thousands of people on it. And Elon's technology skills has really made Spaces a really, really great platform. I mean, you guys should consider jumping on and doing something on there, too. Bloomberg should definitely be doing something on there. And so, like, the way I look at it is he's making the platform.
And we do stuff there, just so you know. We do, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You guys do spaces. And I just think for media organizations, for example, this is a great opportunity to extend your brand, you know. And then at the same respect, as a platform, from the technology perspective, Elon's technology chops are like nobody else's. And there's no question things like Spaces have benefited greatly from these skills, where you can now have several hundred thousand people on a space at the same time. It's kind of incredible. So from that perspective, I think he's been very successful with Twitter. I think the part that's troubling is really how much time he's spending, you know, sort of expanding on his political ideologies and social ideologies, which I would say that a vast majority of people have issues with. So, you know, when you sort of strip out the noise and all the politics, he's done a great job at Twitter. But when you look at the time he's spending on the platform, I don't know if that's always the best use of his time.
So
it's almost never the best use of your time when you're on Twitter.
That's why
Carol doesn't get enough sleep.
No. Well, so wait, with his trip over, you know, and his meetings in Paris, I'm just wondering, so is this a sign that increasingly Europe is going to become a bigger part of what he does and where he devotes his time and where he makes his investments?
Well, there's that, but I think this is more Europe than Tesla because, you know, if you see what, like, the geopolitical situation in Europe, and especially around energy, and with all of a sudden having to sort of decarbonize from Russia in the course of, let's say, less than a year, you know, Europe's really now searching around and saying, how do we become energy independent for real, and how do we use technologies to advance sustainable transportation and energy? And since Tesla's the leader in this, we all should be talking, and now they see what's going on in Germany with the factory there and the success they're starting to have in Germany. And Europeans do love Teslas. So it makes a lot of sense for these countries to be courting Tesla to open up another gigafactory in Europe because, A, it's a very large, you know, the EU is a huge block of EV buyers. And more people buy EVs as a percentage of new cars in Europe and Asia than they do in the United States. So there's a lot of upside for Tesla to continue to expand in Europe and finding a good partner in, you know, sort of, I would say, like, you know, as a competitor to Germany, you know, it's kind of the game I think they're trying to play.
Ross, I was, so I'm test driving this AMG Mercedes this morning. I'm driving in 577 horsepower, and I got absolutely dusted, smoked by a Tesla.
Seriously?
Model S. Yeah, because they're so quick off the line, and it's also much lighter. But I looked at it and I thought, man, it still looks kind of old now. It's getting long in the tooth. Are they going to redesign their fleet at some point?
Well, this is a great, you know, question, and one I don't have a simple answer for because I agree 100%. And Tesla has never really changed their designs that much from their original, you know, make. And then, you know, most car companies try to change their design somewhat almost every year to make, you know, their brands fresh or sort of spruce it up. So we are expecting something with the Model 3 and a spruce up there. But I think this has been kind of one of my issues. I think legitimately Tesla doesn't care about the high-end car market. They're sort of seeding the Model S and X to the Rivians and the Lucids and the other high-end EV makers. And they're sort of saying, our goal is to make cars cheaper and mass affordable than be sort of like a Rivian where we're only going to sell cars to rich people.
Interesting. All right. Hey, Ross, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Ross Gerber, President and CEO at Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management, on the phone from Santa Monica, California. He made a joke about his secret to his drive. Elon Musk was crystal meth at the event in Europe. But he said, I'm only joking.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Friday trade and the week overall, and we are definitely off our best levels. We are down across the board, just slightly down on a percentage basis, the most for the NASDAQ. It's down about 0.5%. So let's see what Carol Schleif has to say. She's Chief Investment Officer at BMO Family Office. She's joining us on Zoom from Minneapolis. Carol, TGIF. I am so glad we're almost done. How are you?
I'm great. I am as well. It's been quite the week.
Well, so help us out here. I mean, we do feel like we're taking a little bit of a breather. Fed meeting, you know, we've had, you know, the S&P piercing 4,400. You know, we're all talking about a new bull market. Not everybody's buying it. There's some disconnect between what Powell says and how the markets read it. So how do you read it? And what do you tell some of your clients?
We've remained in a balanced risk posture, if you will, all along. We were one of the early believers that the Fed was going to be able to stick a soft landing. We've been saying that actually for close to a year and a half, that we thought we had enough resiliency throughout this economy to be able to do it. So, you know, the interesting thing is trying to coax those clients who might be overweighted in cash out of that comfy cash position and to looking at even stepping in, especially those that might have had liquidity
still?
Events.
Haven't they missed it?
I don't know if they've necessarily missed it. It all depends on your perspective. If your perspective is between here and the end of the year, maybe they've missed a good up move this year. But if your perspective is intermediate and longer term, there's an awful lot teed up in this economy to be excited about. It's the first time in decades, you could argue, that we've really decided we were going to make substantial investments in infrastructure and in some key industries. We haven't done that, arguably, since we built out the interstates in the 50s.
That's a very good point. You know who's betting on infrastructure right now? The big short guy.
Exactly. And when you look at
Eisman.
The percentage.
Oh, Eisman. Yes. Yeah. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And you look at the percentage representation that technology and communication services has in the S&P now versus where it was a number of decades ago. And then you look at where manufacturing and industrial have shrunk to. There's a lot of room for uptick in those, and even small upticks take the few component companies in there and push them. So there's, if you're an intermediate or longer term investor, I think investing in some of those technologies makes some sense.
On the other hand, Carol, rates are pretty high. And if you believe that the Fed is going to achieve its goal, right, getting inflation back down to 2%, you can get 5% pretty much risk-free. That's awesome, right?
It's awesome in the short run, but if we do see the Fed bringing the rates back down, the short rates eventually are going to come down. And is the market going to have moved as so much that you choose not to get in? And it's hard because if you're doing investing right at the key points when you need to be trimming and when you need to be buying, it never feels comfortable. In fact, it almost always feels exceptionally uncomfortable if you're doing it right for the long run. Mm. And so that's where, when I mentioned a balanced approach, we're not saying sell all of your cash. We're saying if you're overweighted in cash or short-term fixed income, consider some other alternatives out there, even broaden out the fixed income. And we are getting to a point where we're watching pretty carefully because you've seen yields move up and maybe extending out durations. We're not there yet, but we're watching a lot of things pretty carefully, but also trying to remain invested around the globe. Although, you know, North American progress, especially economically, is
right,
pretty superior relative to the rest of the globe.
I just want to go back to Steve Eisenman because he was a guest on the Bloomberg
Odd Lots.
Right, Odd Lots podcast. And what's interesting is he talks specifically about the biggest story being the grid, and he just talks about the electrification of consumption. So EVs, induction stoves, putting strains on existing infrastructure, and so you're going to have a ton of investment.
As an aside, I will say EVs are fantastic products, really amazing.
But
induction stove is the
worst. I need a flame.
I mean, if you don't have a gas grill, you're doing something wrong.
I agree with you. I need a flame. Carol, do you need a flame?
I do, honestly. And when we redid our house a couple years ago, I have to cook over a gas stove. I'm sorry, but I do.
I know. I cannot work with like an electric stove or anything.
We
like
lived in Germany for the last 6 years, and for some reason, it's all electric there.
It's weird.
You know, a lot of the buildings just aren't hooked up to gas, and it's just, it's a dream come true moving back here, mainly because of my gas range. That's the best thing about America.
Who doesn't love fire, right? So, Carol, where's the risk in this market, though?
Well, I think the risk is getting too long or too hyped up in one particular. It's over-concentrating one place or another. And I think
like
that
big tech? Like big tech?
Yeah, maybe big tech. Although, you know, we do think the interesting thing is we do think the artificial intelligence things has legs longer term, but it's not necessarily investing specifically in it as much as it is making sure every company in your portfolio is paying attention to it and trying to figure out how they're going to adapt
to it. So you think it's cool when like a Kroger talks AI or like anybody talks AI, like they should be talking that because we kind of laugh about it.
They have to be on their front foot as it relates to it. They have to understand that, you know, what their strategy is going to be there. It's early, and folks are trying to understand, too, is the government going to regulate? Is it not going to regulate? How are we going to play it? But I just think being cognizant of it and not ignorant of it, and it's a lot like back in the dot-com days when you don't necessarily want someone just attaching dot-com to their name and saying, oh, we're going to do that now, but they have to have an internet strategy.
Carol, can I ask just from a broader perspective, you've spent decades working with ultra high net worth individuals. Are there traits that they all have in common when it comes to their investment strategies that we, you know,
that they
peons
want to make
don't
money?
Have? No,
I actually think the other nuance to a lot of the high net worth and ultra high net worth families that I've worked with over the years is that the vast majority of them have been first generation. And so one of the really interesting, they're as different as you and I are and everyone, all the population is out there. But one theme that can be really pretty common is no matter how affluent they become, because they started with an idea or simple and it took a lot of risks, a lot of them still fear dying broke. And so it makes them very cognizant of understanding risk and return in their portfolios and not necessarily wanting to take the same kind of risk with their investments that they took making the money in the first place. Because markets can be very, you know, when you're running a company, you can't necessarily control the economy, but you can control your response to it. When you've taken that liquidity and put it in the market, it can be really disconcerting to watch it reprice every second of the day and not understand why, when the fundamentals are going in the direction you expected they were, the stock price or the manager price is going in the opposite direction. And so having a portfolio that's cognizant of what can you control, you can control your costs, you can control turnover, taxes, you can control income.
Carol, we got to run. I'm so sorry. Have a great weekend. Carol Schleif over at BMO Family Office. Look forward to it next time.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.